All right, next up is Jonathan McIntosh. He holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Dallas, has published on Tolkien, Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, and Anselm. Taught political philosophy at the undergraduate and graduate levels and currently serves as a staff elder at Plouffe Fellowship here in Moscow, Idaho. And the title of his talk this evening is Figuratively Speaking, the Old Testament Civil Law, Aquinas, and Libertarianism. Jonathan.
Listening to Nathan's talk, the reform position reminded me of that old bumper sticker that said, God don't make no junk. Anyway, that's the reform position. All right. Well, my topic this evening is the classical natural law view of the Old Testament civil law. We've unintentionally freighted the first end of this tonight's conference with scholasticism. That was just the way it worked out. The classical natural law view of the Old Testament civil law. If you haven't noticed, or maybe you have noticed, the concept of natural law has been enjoying something of a resurgence of interest lately. While this renewal of interest has been going on in Christian academic circles for several decades, natural law talk has been increasingly spilling over into other public spaces more and more in the last few years, such that it almost seems like everyone is talking about natural law these days. And this development is not entirely surprising. Throughout history, the concept of natural law has tended to recede into the background during times of relative social or societal stability, only to come roaring back to the limelight during times of societal and cultural crisis and uncertainty. And ours is certainly one of those times. The reason for this phenomenon has to do with, or might be explained in terms of what might be regarded as the central political claim of the classical natural law tradition. When it comes to the laws that regulate and give order to our lives, civil communities are not free to do whatever they want, but must legislate in a manner consistent with God's universal and transcendent natural law, the moral law that in some sense everyone knows because God has written it on the heart. Yet for Christians, one can scarcely raise the question of natural law without it prompting the almost equally perennial question, what about Old Testament civil law? What are we to make of that? While the theonomist holds biblical law to be still binding today, and that it is consequently biblical law rather than some kind of rationalistic natural law that is the cure for our modern woes, the classical natural law tradition of not only the medieval Catholicism of Aquinas, but also of Orthodox mainstream Protestantism has, and I think rightly, roundly rejected the theonomic error. But granted this denial that it is binding today, what precisely is the classical natural law view of Old Testament civil law? And what might we think about it? In this paper, I will first give a brief overview of what the classical natural law tradition's most widely recognized spokesperson, St. Thomas Aquinas, has to say about the Old Testament civil law. Second, I will raise some of the criticisms I have of the coherence of Aquinas's account. Third and finally, I'll suggest some ways in which I think a Christian natural law libertarianism maybe provides a better understanding of the Old Testament civil law, one that is more consistent with some of Aquinas's more biblically informed principles. So what is the classical natural law view of Old Testament civil law? We begin where Aquinas's philosophy of law does, namely with the definition of law. Law is a rational rule for action made by someone with the authority to make such a rule, directing the community to a common or shared good, and promulgated, if you want to finish the four parts of his definition. Again, law is a rational rule for action made by someone with the authority to make such a rule, directing the community to a common or shared good. So that's his definition of law. The four principal kinds of law in Aquinas' famous and influential taxonomy are eternal law, natural law, human law, and divine law. Eternal law is that law by which God governs everything that exists. Natural law is that subset of God's eternal law by which he governs human beings in particular, in which he is again inscribed within human nature and on every human heart. The natural law is universal, It's unchanging, and it's knowable by human reason. Human law refers to those laws that human beings make and enforce on each other in the context of human civil society. Finally, divine law is any and all law that God has revealed in sacred scripture. Now, the fact that we have all these other forms of law, eternal law, natural law, human law, prompts the question for Aquinas, what need do we have then for yet another law, namely divine law? Aquinas gives four answers. First, man has two ends that we heard about earlier in Nathan's talk. Like other animals, man has a natural end of a this-worldly, temporal human happiness, capable of being reached by natural means. As a spiritual being, however, man also has a supernatural end, namely knowledge of and union with God, which can only be reached by the supernatural means of divine grace. Although we just heard from Nathan that this picture is actually a little more complicated than this, but set that aside for now. Whereas the natural law is capable of directing man to his natural end, man needs a supernatural law to direct him to his supernatural end. And this law is provided by or within divine law of sacred scripture. So that's the first reason why we need divine law. Second reason we need divine law that Aquinas gives is that even within the realm of nature and of man's temporal happiness, human reason can often go astray or misinterpret the natural law. And so God has also graciously provided within divine law an infallible guide to the natural law. A third reason for divine law has to do with the deficiency, this time not with natural law or ability to know natural law, but with human law itself. Human or man-made law within a political society is only able to address man's outward, external, bodily actions, whereas man also needs to have his interior passions well-ordered. For this reason, God saw fit to give a divine law that would regulate the interior emotions of the heart, to fill in those things that human law couldn't do. A fourth and final need for divine law is that even in regard to those external actions that human law, in principle, might be able to regulate, if human law tried to forbid all such evil, external evil actions, Aquinas says it could do so only at the cost of forbidding many good things as well. There is a good, in other words, to legally permitting certain evil actions. And yet there needs to be some law prohibiting these evil actions, even the ones that human law cannot reach. And this is what divine law does. So those are Aquinas' four reasons why divine law is needed. Yet even divine law, they're philosophical arguments for the necessity of sacred doctrine, of sacred scripture, of divine law, which is interesting. Yet for Aquinas, not all divine law is of a piece. Aquinas next explains why there is not one divine law, but in fact two, an old law of the Old Testament and the new law of the New Testament. And here Aquinas gives three explanations for this division based on three anthropological distinctions. The first distinction is that, as noted earlier, man has not one but two ends, a natural this-worldly end of temporal human happiness and a supernatural end of eternal happiness with God. As Aquinas interprets it, the old law of Moses principally directed the ancient Israelites to their natural end of temporal happiness, whereas it is the new law of the gospel that directs us to our supernatural end of union with God. So that temporal, those two ends that Nathan talked about earlier, Aquinas uses that to explain why we have an Old Testament in our Bible and a New Testament. The second anthropological distinction explaining why we have two divine laws is the distinction between man's external actions, which Aquinas says the old law served to regulate, and man's internal motions of the heart, which is the special jurisdiction of the new law of the gospel. And the third anthropological distinction has to do with the two ways in which men may be moved to action. One is by way of coercion, or fear of punishment, as Aquinas puts it, which is how the old law operated. And the other way in which people are moved to action is by persuasion, or by love, to quote Aquinas, by love, which is poured into our hearts by the grace of Christ, end quote. So, in addition to eternal, natural, and human law, Aquinas argues it was necessary for there to be a divine law, and yet because of human nature, this divine law has come to us in two distinct forms or stages, the old law and the new. Focusing now specifically on the old law, Aquinas classifies this into three categories that have since become standard way of dividing up Old Testament law. There are the moral precepts, the ceremonial precepts, and the judicial precepts. There are earlier church fathers who kind of hinted at this classification, but Aquinas is really the one who codifies it, and you find it in the Westminster Confession, for example. Everybody accepts this distinction, more or less. The moral precepts are, of course, simply the natural law as revealed in Scripture, and examples include the Ten Commandments and the two greatest commandments. The ceremonial precepts are those laws directing the Israelites in their external actions of worship vertically, if you will, towards God. And the judicial precepts are those laws that ordered the Israelites in their horizontal relations of justice with each other. Now, to zoom in further on the judicial precepts in particular, the way Aquinas, and with him the natural law tradition more generally, views these judicial precepts is as follows. Just as the task of human law in every civil society is to take the universal and unchanging moral standards of the natural law and adapt and apply them to that society's unique circumstances, so what the judicial precepts of the old law represented were God taking the moral precepts of the old law, which is also the natural law, and adapting and applying and enforcing those moral precepts to ancient Israel's unique circumstance. The judicial precepts, in other words, were a case of God doing infallibly, perfectly, what every human legislator does fallibly or imperfectly, adapting and applying the unchanging universal natural law to a particular community's contingent, changing, and unique situation. The judicial precepts thus represent a case of divine positive law. Divine because they come from a divine legislator, God, but positive in the sense that these laws derive their authority not directly from nature or reason, and therefore are not necessarily universally applicable, but they derive their authority from the fact that the lawmaker authorized these laws for this particular situation. But had circumstances been different, he might have posited different laws instead. And this, incidentally, is the basis for the natural law tradition's rejection of theonomy. By universalizing the judicial precepts and holding them to be still binding today, theonomy not only misunderstands the nature of the judicial precepts, but what it is that civil law is and does. In the way the judicial precepts offer a contingent, prudential adaptation and specification of more general moral precepts to concrete circumstances, the judicial precepts are in fact more like the ceremonial precepts and less like the moral precepts than the theonomist would care to admit. In addition to them both being instances of positive law, Aquinas draws attention to yet another respect in which the judicial precepts are similar to the ceremonial precepts. And this is one that I will return to in the critique portion of my paper. On the one hand, Aquinas says that the judicial precepts, these were primarily civil or political in their function, being concerned in the first instance with the justice of the community. On the other hand, because the Hebrew people were a typological people, pointing forward in their very being to a future eschatological reality, namely what Aquinas calls the mystery of Christ, the judicial precepts by which the Israelites were civically ordered, Aquinas maintains, were also like the ceremonial precepts, in that they too had a figurative dimension as well. That's his word, figurative, or at least the English translation. So the ceremonial precepts were primarily figurative, the ceremonial precepts. But Aquinas says that the judicial precepts were also figurative, albeit in a secondary fashion. Now, these limitations that Aquinas puts on the present-day applicability of the judicial precepts, notwithstanding, when Aquinas turns to consider the judicial precepts in some detail, what especially interests him is not their irrelevance, but their abiding relevance, or what Aquinas calls their suitability. The judicial precepts may not be binding, but they are eminently reasonable. The judicial precepts, after all, were, on Aquinas' reckoning, the product of God doing as a divine legislator what every human legislator is tasked with doing, namely adapting and applying natural law to society's unique circumstances. And because God knew what he was doing and did it perfectly, human legislators not only can, but must learn from the master, the divine master, by studying the judicial precepts. I think if the theonomists of the last century had better understood this aspect of the classical natural law tradition, they might have avoided a needless and somewhat fruitless debate. As he reads them, the judicial precepts of the old law, as Aquinas reads them, the judicial precepts of the old law provided adequate legislation for four principal kinds of social relations among the ancient Israelites. First, they regulated relations between rulers and subjects, principally by outlining an ideal form of government comprised of a mixed constitution, part monarchy, part aristocracy, and part democracy. Second, the judicial precepts helped regulate relations between citizen and citizen, with Aquinas giving special attention to the way the judicial precepts establish private property while encouraging the use of that property for the benefit of others. In addition to property law, moreover, Aquinas takes stock of the provisions that judicial precepts made for matters of inheritance law, commercial law, lending law, labor law, judicial process, rules of evidence, and penal codes, all of which served a range of civic and economic activities. Aquinas is quite impressed with the comprehensiveness of the judicial precepts. And then third, the judicial precepts regulated relations between citizens and foreigners, stipulating the just treatment of aliens and how matters of war and peace were to be conducted. The fourth and final category of relations overseen by the judicial precepts were those within the household, namely those existing between master and servants, husbands and wives, and parents and children. This, then, is my overview of the natural law doctrine of the Old Testament civil law, as first and authoritatively set down by St. Thomas Aquinas. And while there's much that is insightful and helpful in this account that we can and should learn from, I want to turn now to what I take to be some of the principal defects of this natural law theory of the Old Testament civil law. My criticisms are threefold, and because time is short, I'm only going to be able to do these in cursory fashion, and we can explore them maybe more in the Q&A. My first criticism, and which, again, I can only touch on in passing, is that Aquinas, unfortunately, doesn't, I would submit, really have a clear sense of the role of coercion in distinguishing civil law generally. And I think this defect spills over into his view of the Old Testament civil law in particular. As Aquinas characterizes them, what the judicial precepts represent is not a coercive enforcement of select moral precepts, which is, I think, how he should have characterized them, but rather he views them merely as a further specification of the moral precepts, despite the fact that the moral precepts come with their own specification on Aquinas' own account. So Aquinas is very criterion for differentiating the moral precepts from the judicial precepts is really a distinction without any real substantive difference. And the reason I think this is important is because if you don't understand that what distinguishes the judicial precepts from the moral precepts, or what distinguishes, you know, crimes from sins, or just human law from natural law generally, if you don't understand that what distinguishes these things is the law's coercive character, and hence the limitations that attend the use of coercion, you are inevitably going to be naive and careless in how you see the judicial precepts as applying today. And as we'll see in my third critique, I think Aquinas is guilty of such an error. Second defect I see in Aquinas' account has to do with his failure to consistently apply the limits he himself initially places both on human civil law and on Old Testament civil law. Again, I can't spend a lot of time on this, but basically I would say that despite what I would characterize as his almost libertarian account of the limits he puts first on human law and then on Old Testament civil law, he later goes on to virtually abandon these limits in favor of a much more optimistic Aristotelian view of civil law, which is that it exists to lead men to virtue and happiness. Okay, his old earlier account of why we have divine law involved a kind of suppression of what divine law can accomplish. And then when he's opening up divine law and arguing, explaining why there's a new law and an old law, it involves a limiting of what the old law could accomplish. And I think those limits end up just kind of disappearing later on in his account. Well, this brings me to my third and final critique of Aquinas' account, and that is his failure to consistently apply what he himself acknowledges to be the at least partly figurative or typological character of the Old Testament civil law. As we have seen, Aquinas imposes not one, but in fact two major qualifications on any attempt to interpret and apply the judicial precepts. First, the judicial precepts represent a particular, contingent, historically contextualized application of more general natural law or moral precept principles. And so any attempt to interpret and apply the judicial precepts need to take that particular contingent historical contextualization into account. And that's usually where it seems to me most of the discussion, the limits of applying judicial precepts, where it basically stops. But I think we need to go further. Because it turns out that the judicial precepts weren't in fact purely political, but were at least partly figurative, typological, symbolic, or as we might say, religious in character. And what this means is that a purely political interpretation of the judicial precepts is never possible, as one has to ask not just what God as legislator was trying to accomplish civically with this law, but also what he was doing figuratively or historically redemptively. And yet in his own interpretation of many of the specific judicial precepts, Aquinas routinely fails to ask this question, or at least it seems so to me. Prime example of this, I think, is his interpretation of the Jubilee Law, whose primary function for Aquinas is not to keep the tribes distinct, for example, because of their figurative significance, but is instead an illustration of Aristotle's principle that land ownership should be regulated for the better ordering of society and to keep too much land from concentrating in too few hands. Never mind that if you think about it, implementing the Jubilee Law had to have been hugely chaotic and would have actually tended to concentrate land in fewer hands. God had other reasons, I think, for the Jubilee Law than the ones Aquinas gives. But Aristotle's blinding him to this, I think. Other examples include Aquinas' tendency to overgeneralize and hence overapply such laws as Israel's inheritance laws, gleaning laws, laws regarding slavery, and usury. Throughout his defense of the suitability of the judicial precepts, what Aquinas characteristically does is show how a certain judicial precept aligns with the political teaching of Aristotle. Moses, in other words, is suitable because he can be made to conform to Aristotle. If Aquinas more faithfully attended to his own acknowledgement of the figurative nature of the judicial precepts, by contrast, I think it would significantly disrupt the connections Aquinas is able to find between Aristotle and Moses. Aquinas should be getting his hermeneutic for reading Moses, not from Aristotle, but from Paul. If he did, the result, I submit, would be a very different understanding of what model the judicial precepts offer for political philosophy today. This brings me finally to the respect in which I think a Christian natural law libertarianism is able to do a better job integrating these different elements within the classical natural law doctrine of Aquinas than Aquinas himself does. First, natural law libertarianism is at its very heart a political ethic of coercion. Its singular thesis is that under normal circumstances, i.e. those not involving special divine positive law, or especially those circumstances, the use of coercion is morally limited to responding to acts of aggression. The natural law libertarian corrective to Aquinas thus better understands that what makes law to be law is its use of coercion. And it forces, no pun intended, the natural law question of when is a society's use of coercion in law morally permissible. A natural law libertarianism is also better able to consistently apply the limits Aquinas himself puts, at least initially, on human and divine civil law. There are many things that civil law just simply cannot do. And in his more overtly biblical and Christian moments, I think Aquinas recognizes this. Until and unless Aristotle seducing him into this grander, much more optimistic view of human law. Third, a natural law libertarianism is in a position to better observe the figurative dimension of Old Testament civil law, as it more consistently recognizes that what God was trying to do specifically with the judicial precepts was something far more than merely political. God was not just playing the Aristotelian legislator. As absurd as that might sound, that's basically what Aquinas makes him to be. Rather, God was doing something radically sui generis, entirely unique. He was legislating for a people that were both positively to anticipate the Messiah and also to negatively anticipate him by giving them a law that they could not keep, that could not deliver them over to even a temporal happiness, and what is more, in an important sense, it was never intended to do so, but which is actually intended to do the opposite, namely to bring about condemnation, failure. See Romans 7. Far from providing some kind of model of civic order, or model civic order, the judicial precepts deliberately, I'm not saying that's entirely not the case, that the judicial precepts do provide an ideal order, but that's not all that's going on there. More than that, the judicial precepts deliberately over-legislated in some areas, as Paul indicates, but also deliberately under-legislated in others, as Jesus indicates. See, for example, his teaching on divorce. Compare that with that of Deuteronomy. The Old Testament law was too permissive, even politically, legally, one might say. So God had something else going on there. This does not mean that a natural law libertarianism is going to be more skeptical, or it does mean that the natural law libertarianism is going to be more skeptical of what applications we can directly or even indirectly draw from Old Testament civil law. This is only because it aspires to be more consistently modest in those applications. In this way, it is better able, I think, to appreciate what Aquinas himself recognized about the limits of both human and divine civil law, and the self-marginalizing or relativizing aspect of the inherently figurative or typology, even if it's secondarily so, the planned obsolescence character of Old Testament civil law. And I bring all of this up because I think it is something that many adherents of the classical natural law tradition, especially today, many of those on, you know, the were described as the new Christian right. This is something that needs to be taken stock of, and I don't think it's enough attention is being given to it. For certain of these proponents of classical natural law theory, ignoring the figurative character of Old Testament civil law is advantageous because it means, on the one hand, we're not woodenly limited to a strict application of the judicial precepts as the theonomists would require, while on the other hand, we're still permitted to invoke biblical authority for whatever rules we might like to forcibly impose on the rest of society in pursuit of our preferred social order, rules which include things like religious establishment and curtailing religious liberty. The judicial precepts in this way become a kind of wax nose that in the name of a prudential application of the natural law, we are able to bend in whatever direction we choose. On the model of Christian natural law libertarianism promoted here, by contrast, a greater distinction and distance may be preserved between those things which ought, in Aquinas' words, fall under the fear of punishment, and those extra legal matters where social change is best accomplished, once again, to quote Aquinas, by love, which is poured into our hearts by the grace of Christ. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the George Buchanan Forum Conference. We have many more that you can check out at our website at tgbf.org. You can also find us on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. In true free market fashion, we're entirely crowdfunded by the generous support of people like you. If you'd like to help our work, you can set up one-time or recurring donations at tgbf.org. The best way for others to hear about us is from their friends. So please consider liking, subscribing, and sharing our material. We greatly appreciate it.